This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Central Time, Edward Snowden risked his career, reputation, maybe life when he revealed the NSA's widespread gathering of Americans' phone and internet records. We'll talk to an expert about whistleblowing and what to know before deciding to take that step. First, the Supreme Court yesterday ruled on the John Doe investigation into coordination between conservative groups and Scott Walker's recall campaign, saying the coordination law was vague and unconstitutional. In the wake of that decision, two Wisconsin lawmakers are calling for changes to the state's John Doe procedures. Senator Tom Tiffany from Hazelhurst and Representative Dave Craig from Big Bend are proposing changes that would limit the use of John Doe probes and remove some of the secrecy from the process. Republican State Senator Tom Tiffany joins us now. Senator Tiffany, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, good afternoon.
So the basics, why do you think the John Doe procedures need some revisions?
Well, as highlighted by the court yesterday, the state Supreme Court, the process has been abused. And so we, Representative Craig and I, proposed to put some limits on the John Doe process. We're one of the only states that use a John Doe process. Most states use a grand jury process. And so it's been very broad. And it's not been abused by prosecutors, generally speaking, in the past. But this abuse is highly unusual, and Representative Craig and I are saying that there should be some reforms made to it. Not throw it out, but to reform it.
Yeah, so talk us through some of the specific changes that you're looking for.
Yeah, a few of the things that we want to do is, first of all, anyone that is charged in a John Doe, there's a gag order put on them. They cannot speak to anyone, including an attorney. And that's the federal courts, including the federal Supreme Court, ruled years ago that's unconstitutional. We need to catch up with the times and lift those gag orders that have been put on people with John Doe's here in Wisconsin. So that would be one of them. The other is to have these have the process be basically an unlimited timeline. We would put six-month increments into it that prosecutors would have to come back to a 10-judge panel and say, okay, yes, you get another 6 months to continue this probe.
And are there any other changes apart from those two, the secrecy, the gag order, and the time limits that you want to see here?
Yeah, those are the primary elements to the bill that we've proposed.
And does this cripple the law? Does it make it ultimately a useless law with those things in place? Or do you think it can still be used to prosecute the kind of crimes usually involving government corruption that it's intended for?
Yeah, we've passed this through committee in the state Senate, and it's sitting waiting to be scheduled for a vote of the full Senate. And we've had lengthy discussions with all involved, including prosecutors, the Department of Justice, and others. And we believe we're at a good place now with the bill and that it should go to a full vote now. And Representative Craig and I are calling for a full vote in both houses of the legislature right after Labor Day when we come back into session.
Right. You're out of session now. You say, and your colleague, Representative Craig, it said this should be a top priority when you do come back in the fall. Why do you see this as urgent, something that needs to get passed as soon as possible?
Because the type of John Doe abuses that we've seen and that the state Supreme Court said are illegal yesterday, they could still be going on now. We need this reform now. I think a very important point, you know, many people, I suspect, had not heard of the John Doe process without this high-profile case involving Governor Walker and conservatives. But we had a number of defense attorneys that came in and testified and said, this process is being abused by people of average means also. And they were very vocal in saying, this is not just about Governor Walker. There needs to be reforms to protect people, to protect their privacy and protect them against unlawful search and seizure that we've seen gone on with this very high-profile case that came before the Supreme Court.
Talking to Senator Tom Tiffany from Hazelhurst. He's one of a pair of lawmakers looking for changes in the state's John Doe laws after yesterday's state Supreme Court ruling, effectively ending the current or what had been the current John Doe investigation of Governor Walker's recall election campaign and outside groups. Now, John Doe has netted real prosecutions and convictions in the past. In John Doe 1, some of Governor Walker's former staffers back in the today, former Democratic Senator Chuck Kwala in 2005. It's in some cases done what it's supposed to do in pursuing cases of alleged government corruption. Would we still have what we need in place to pursue those things?
Well, prosecutors have the ability to be able to file charges if there's impropriety being done by elected officials at any level in the state of Wisconsin. Prosecutors still have the tools to be able to unearth that wrongdoing. This does not stop that from happening.
Now, you talked about the abuses in this John Doe case. The prosecutors have said, as they read state law, they were pursuing real potential wrongdoing here. The state Supreme Court effectively said, well, the law that you're talking about was too vague and unconstitutional. So were they really going beyond their purview in the way they pursued this?
I believe they were. I mean, I'm not sure. Whenever I talk to people, and I explained to them the tactics that were used when they took floodlights and lit up people's homes in pre-dawn raids. They went in dressed in SWAT gear, you know, fully weaponized. In some instances, I've been told that they had weapons drawn. I mean, it was meant to intimidate because these were people that were not going to be violent or anything like that. And then when they pulled people's records, their kids' pictures, they took the cell phones and computers of the children in the home. It clearly was meant to intimidate, and it was a fishing expedition. They went far beyond what I believe what is a common sense way to go about trying to prosecute this.
As I understand it, other states just use guidance from federal laws, as you've alluded to, federal grand jury laws. Why wouldn't Wisconsin just do that and scrap John Doe separate provisions completely?
Yeah, we talked to prosecutors across the state, talked to the Department of Justice when we were looking at doing this, and that was a suggestion by some members of the state Senate was, let's just go to the grand jury system. And the prosecutors really asked us to keep the John Doe system. They said it's a good system. It's simply been abused here by the district attorney in Milwaukee County and others. Don't throw this out just because a few people abused it. Make some necessary changes. We've worked with prosecutors to do that. And let's make the John Doe process work as it should.
Now, from the outside, this might look like politicians trying to change the law so that politicians can get away with a little bit more. There's a recent outcry over open records changes that came and went in the budget. Do you see that potential perception out there that this is something to make life easier for people who are already in office?
Yeah, you know, some people are going to make that charge, but nothing could be further from the truth. There is still the ability, if there are elected representatives at any level of state government that are conducting illegal activities, they can be charged and they can be brought to justice. This doesn't change that in any way. And I agree with George Stanley, the Milwaukee Journal editor, who said this past weekend in regards to the open records case, this was an example of a big win for the people of the state of Wisconsin, in that there will not be changes. People value openness in government. I know I do. And the people of the state of Wisconsin will still have the accountability to make sure that elected officials follow the law.
And before I let you go, Senator Tiffany, you're looking to introduce this officially, get it voted on after Labor Day. Have you heard from your colleagues in the Senate and the Assembly whether they are supportive of these changes?
I've heard from some, not all. That's going to be part of my job here over the next month and a half, is to make sure that we can get the votes in the state Senate. And I'm hoping that Democrats will join along. I mean, think about it. The defense bar is very much in support of these changes. They're not natural allies of us Republican conservatives on many issues, but they're fully in favor of changes to the John Doe law because they've seen those abuses amongst people of average and poor means. And so I hope some Democrats are going to join us also in supporting this legislation.
Senator Tiffany, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for the time.
That's State Senator Tom Tiffany, Republican from Hazelhurst, talking about the state's use of John Doe probes and changes he'd like to see in the John Doe regulations. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. 2 years ago, Edward Snowden leaked hundreds of thousands of classified government documents that revealed the inner workings of the U.S. government's security network and set off a debate about government surveillance still going on today. Those leaks also prompted a heated debate over whistleblowing, whether someone like Snowden is a whistleblowing hero or a traitor, as some said, whether they're protecting democracy or endangering lives. Closer to home, whistleblowers actively tried to bring attention to problems at a VA facility in Tomah. They faced retaliation from management before the story got into the public eye. In these and other cases, whistleblowers risked their reputations, their careers, in some cases maybe their lives, prompting the question, what should you know before you decide to blow the whistle? With us now is Stephen Cohn, Executive Director of the National Whistleblowers Center and author of the book, The Whistleblower's Handbook. Stephen, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Now, you in your book made the point that whistleblowers have been crucial to the United States since the very beginning. How important are whistleblowers in our culture, our society?
Well, it's been fully documented that whistleblowers today are the number one source of all fraud recoveries in government contracting and procurement. They're clearly the number one source for identifying fraud in securities industry, government contracting, and taxes. So if you want to detect that type of corruption, you must protect and encourage the whistleblower.
So how do we do that? How do we protect whistleblowers and encourage them?
Well, Congress finally caught on. As people studied how fraud is detected, and study after study concluded that the whistleblower was the key, including a major study out of the University of Chicago, they found out that you need to encourage these people. They're their sources. Fraud is designed to be hidden, and you need the employee to come out and report it. So they decided to combine essentially a carrot and a stick. The stick is, if you're fired for blowing the whistle, then you can sue your company. But they wanted to avoid that. So the carrot is, if you give the government high-quality information that documents a fraud, and it's used for a successful enforcement action, the whistleblower can collect a percentage of the monies received by the government. This is what's known as a reward, a whistleblower reward.
Let's take this from the perspective of a potential whistleblower. Somebody at an organization, say a business, a government agency, who says, I see something going on here. I see taxpayer money illegally being appropriated or a fraud at my company. But gosh, if I report this, I could be retaliated against, fired, threatened, could ruin my career. So what does that whistleblower do to do things right, to protect themselves in the long run?
A fantastic question. I think, so let's just take it right from the beginning. So you're the whistleblower. So say you work for a government contractor. It's critical to figure out who you work for to determine your level of protection. But for this hypothetical, the whistleblower works for a government contractor. They see that they got a contract to build a bridge, but they're using terrible and below-grade cement. And the cement they're using violates the requirements of that government contract. So they blow the whistle. Now, if they use the False Claims Act, they can do this, at least initially, completely confidentially, filed under seal. And if the government comes in and investigates and finds that it was the wrong cement, and they then bill out that contractor for their fraud and their damages, say it was a $25 million mistake, intentional. So now it's $25 million of damage to the government. The law has a treble damage requirement, which says you triple it. So if you rip off the government $25 million, you owe the government $75 million. And then the whistleblower who turned that in could obtain between 15 and 30% of that $75 million. In other words, a very large reward. And many whistleblowers get large rewards. That's in exchange because it's the issue you stated in the very beginning. Most employees are afraid of being fired. And if they do blow the whistle and they are caught, most likely their careers will be ruined. So these laws had to figure out a way to encourage workers to take that risk, to risk the destruction of their career. And the way they did that was by setting up a reward structure. And that's how the False Claims Act works for government contracting. There's a similar law for securities fraud, commodities fraud, tax fraud, and people who disclose foreign bribery. Now, if you're not in those categories, then generally all you have is a law that you would get reinstatement and back pay and maybe some other damages if you're fired. Those laws are weak and generally do not work.
We're talking to Stephen Cohn, author of The Whistleblower's Handbook, about the role of whistleblowers in American business and government trying to prevent fraud. And Stephen, one accusation that's leveled against some whistleblowers, often in military settings or in the case of Edward Snowden, is that, hey, the appropriate way to do things is first to go through chain of command, report it to superiors, to their superiors if they don't respond, to Congress in some cases. Only then, if you haven't gotten redress, should you go public with this information. Is there something to that?
Well, going public is a constitutional right. It's protected in the First Amendment. The American people have a right to know. And that's codified in our Constitution. However, the cases that have evaluated it do permit a balancing test between the government's legitimate secrecy interests and the public right to know. So if you're going to go straight to the press, say about a government fraud or corruption of a government official, as a whistleblower, you're at risk. Because it's up to the courts to weigh that balance. And if they weigh the balance against you, you're going to be fired and have no rights. But if they weigh the balance in your favor, you'll be protected under a very strong constitutional law that does provide for jury trials and punitive damage. So going to the press is the most risky way to blow the whistle.
And I'm thinking of cases with Edward Snowden again, where it wasn't necessarily fraud or anything with a price tag. It was behavior that, right or wrong, Edward Snowden thought the people had a right to know about government surveillance, among other things. Here in Wisconsin, we had a scandal at a VA facility where whistleblowers said, hey, pain medications are being overprescribed. It wasn't necessarily ripping off taxpayer money. Are those kind of whistleblowers, without that dollar amount, that without that reward, are they whistleblowers? Do they have the protections they need?
Well, we'll break it up into three, your question. First is there are protections for environmental whistleblowers, nuclear safety whistleblowers, food safety, occupational safety. So in the area of health and safety, there are laws. But they're weaker than, say, the False Claims Act. And they do prohibit retaliation, but I've worked those laws for over 30 years. They're hard, the cases are long, costly, and they're difficult to win. So those laws really don't encourage whistleblowers, but they will protect a whistleblower if they're fired and have a good case. But let's now go to the VA. A VA employee is protected under a whole separate slew of laws, primarily the Whistleblower Protection Act. And that law does cover disclosures to the news media. So if you're releasing, say, patient confidential information, you won't be protected. But if you're just blowing the whistle on patient safety and other types of abuses, you should be. Now let's hit Snowden. Snowden falls in a very small class of whistleblowing. It's called national security intelligence. Back in 1978, when the first federal whistleblower law was passed, these intelligence agencies lobbied and got excluded from the whistleblower laws. So if someone's working at the CIA or the NSA, they don't have any law to protect them for blowing the whistle. Forget going to the press. Even blowing the whistle to their own supervisor, there's no protection. And from our perspective, that was a distortion. It never should have been enacted. Even if they wanted to put restrictions on the way intelligence agency whistleblowers could make a disclosure, no, to protect state secrets. But the exclusion of these employees from any protection whatsoever was a terrible, terrible mistake. Now, just add one and one together. Whistleblowers are key for the detection of misconduct. Absolutely key. But then you exclude this entire class of workers from the intelligence agencies from these protections. What do you get? You get all the foul-ups we see, the foul-ups leading to 9/11, the foul-ups with the Iraqi war, because the people who work there, who know the truth, have no mechanism.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Stephen Cohn, author of The Whistleblower's Handbook. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Tomorrow is Fish Day in Port Washington, Wisconsin. It's billed as the world's largest one-day outdoor fish fry with 9 fish and chip stands to choose from, among other things. And even if you're not in Port Washington, it is Friday here in Wisconsin. That means there's a good chance you're going to be eating fish fry tonight. So for today's Food Friday, we celebrate the tradition of fish fry in Wisconsin. In a few minutes, we'll talk to the executive chef of a place that knows its fish fries, the Packing House in Milwaukee. Nick Sheeler has advice for making great fish fry at home. Kyle Cherik joins us first. He's the host of the Emmy-nominated public television show, Wisconsin Foodie. Kyle, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be back. How are you today?
Well, I'm good. Now, you have traveled the state sniffing out all kinds of food and food traditions. How big a deal is the fish fry here in Wisconsin?
It's, well, for Wisconsin and particularly southeastern Wisconsin, or I would say the southern part of the state, it's deep cultural culinary roots. I mean, the city of Milwaukee became a chartered city in 1846. The state became a state in 1848. And within that time, the ethnic groups that were coming in, Scandinavians, but more importantly, Germans, and primarily, it's really fascinating, Germany's first sort of ethnic area that immigrated over to America and came to Wisconsin was southern German, southeastern to be specific, primarily Bavarians and so forth. And if it weren't for them coming first, I don't know that we would have the fish fry tradition that we have, because northern Germany, those of you that know your religious history, was Lutheran and Protestant, and southern Germany was Catholic. And the Catholic Germans were told not to eat meat on Fridays to observe their religion. So you've got to eat something. And being on one of the Great Great Lakes with abundant, you know, caches of fish, we have a tradition that's born.
And abundant fish, not terribly expensive fish. So this wasn't something that was necessarily a fancy food tradition, was it?
That's right. No, not at all. I mean, Wisconsin is really an interesting state because our first cash crop and the big crop that so many of the immigrants would have had a part in was wheat. People don't realize that if you were a cowboy heading west on the wagon train, or if you were a society lady in Boston, or a slave when the South was still under slavery, baking, there was a 60% chance that wheat had been shipped out of Wisconsin and grown in Wisconsin. And so there was a strong working class, and fish was abundant, and flour, obviously, for the batter, and beer was coming on, which is where we get the beer batter tradition. And this was a very working class, affordable, easy, and you didn't have to be Jacques Pepin or Julian Child to make a fish fry. It's We do it at home with our kids, and it's a pretty straightforward experience.
Now,
it's not rocket science.
All right, Kyle, some ethnic food traditions have not become the norm in Wisconsin. We're not all eating lutefisk, for example.
And that's right.
Some of us are okay with that, by the way. Why did this one stick? Why did it go beyond that German ethnic heritage to the rest of us?
Sure. It's a combination of really the taverns and the rise of the breweries through the latter part of the 19th century in Wisconsin, and the tied houses where a brewery would build the tavern and only that beer would be sold there. And the fish fry with a large Catholic population throughout the state, whether it was Swedes or Germans or Poles, which were those were sort of the biggest ethnic groups that came around that turn of the century time. The fish fry was basically an easy way to get food into the taverns and to get people into the taverns. We don't think of it now, but the taverns of the 1880s and 1890s and 1870s, et cetera, were very much like the British public house, where it was primarily men. It wasn't families, but it could be families on a Friday night where you could get an inexpensive meal. There was conviviality with your working class, with the people that you went to church with the people that were in your neighborhood, and you could afford to feed a big brood, and you were within the parameters of whatever your bishop said was the right thing to do on that Friday.
So, Kyle, before I let you go, what are a couple of your favorite places to go for a good fish fry?
Well, the Packing House, for sure. They do it beautifully. They do it. They're part of that Polish tradition on the South Side when it was a huge political machine and neighborhood machine and economic machine, and I think they're a city treasure. Serb Hall, obviously, they do a beautiful fish fry, and they've been hanging on. And then I have to say, I don't even know if it's still going, but the Knights of Columbus, when I was a kid growing up in Waukesha, we would go at least once a month. And that huge banquet hall, and it was kids and the elderly and families and everybody enjoying and running around. And that warmth of what food and bringing community together is part of my memory banks. It's part of my blood.
Kyle, thanks a lot for sharing that tradition with us.
You bet. You bet. Have a great weekend. And Prost.
All right.
Having a beer with your fish fry.
That's Kyle Cherik, host of the Emmy-nominated show Wisconsin Foodie, which airs on Wisconsin Public Television. Well, now we go to Nick Sheeler. He's executive chef at the Packing House. We just heard about that in Milwaukee. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So what says Wisconsin to you about the Friday fish fry?
The feud. Part of people believe it ought to be beer battered. The other half believe that it ought to be breaded.
And do you come down on one side or the other, or are you willing to play both sides of the aisle there?
Honestly, as far as I'm concerned, it depends on the piece of fish.
Oh, okay. So what kinds of fish demand beer in the batter? Not to be drunk with it. All of them you can drink beer with, I imagine.
Right. I find that most of the ocean fish take well to beer batter, your cod, your haddock, pollock occasionally, whereas I find that the freshwater fish tend to handle the breading better. The freshwater fish also tend to be thinner, so if you're battering and then deep frying a piece of perch, it's going to curl up into a tiny little spiral, and that's not good for anybody.
Now let's dig into the cooking a little. We can get good fish fry at supper clubs, bars, church basements around the state. Is it possible to do a good fish fry at home?
Absolutely.
All right, what's the secret? What's the tip? Let's start with the fish. What kind of fish do you recommend? Maybe the novice fish fry home cook. What's a good place to start?
Honestly, the best place to start is the simplest place to start. Get yourself a nice stick of cod from the freezer at the grocery store.
Yeah, and that's a lot of times if it doesn't say different, you could assume it seems like the fish fry at your local restaurant is cod. So that's an easy way to go.
That is the standard. That's the default setting for the Wisconsin fish fry is the cod.
And that's an ocean fish. So let me see if I learned my lesson. I should do that in a beer batter.
Some places will. Here at the Packing House, we are strictly on the breaded side of the debate. So here at the Packing House, we do our cod breaded.
Breaded. Okay. Now, you sent us a recipe for breading, your ingredients, and how to. We've got that, by the way, linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Can you talk us through the basic breading recipe?
Yeah, I can do that for you. Kyle was saying, it's a real traditional thing. It's very easy. It was easy to do in the taverns in the 1880s, so it's easy to do in your kitchen. First off, you're going to start with about a pound of fine breadcrumbs. These should be real easy to find at your grocery store. Then you'll need a tablespoon of granulated onion, a little bit of black pepper, a little bit of iodized salt, and then just a tiny little pinch of cayenne pepper to help offset some of the fattiness that you're going to be picking up when deep frying it. You'll just mix all those dry ingredients together. Now, with your fish, you're going to want to thaw it out completely. You don't want to start with a frozen piece of fish at all. You want it totally thawed out, and you want to pat it dry. Then you're just going to dip that in some unseasoned flour, shake off the excess. Then you'll dip that in a little bit of egg wash. I like to use about 3 parts milk, 1 part egg in our wash. Then you'll just shake off the excess egg wash as well. And then you're going to put that right into your breadcrumb mixture. Roll it around, press it in real lightly, but with most fish, delicacy is key, so you don't want to be mashing up the fine grain on the fish. And then once you got the breadcrumbs on, just pull it out, shake it off, and that can go right into your little deep fryer right at home.
And do we have to deep fry, or can we pan fry it in some oil in a pan one side then the other?
You can absolutely pan fry it. When I make it at home, that's how I do it.
Do you end up with a little less oiliness that way?
Not really. If you're deep frying
that batter's going to soak it up. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're deep frying at the right temperature, actually the fish isn't going to pick up a whole lot of oil. The moisture exiting the fish will actually force the grease away. So, a good fish fry should be nice and crispy, but, about the oil will really only penetrate the breading layer. So,
well, let's go up to our 201. That was 101. Let's go up to our 201 class. Now, I'm never going to say no to cod, but I've had some great fish fries with other kinds of fish. What are the next ones we should explore after we've got the cod down?
Number two on the list is always going to be perch. It's a standard staple around here. We go through mostly cod around here, but we do serve quite a bit of perch. Yellow Lake perch, that's pretty easy to get your hands on. However, my personal favorite is the walleye.
Yes. I'll say some of the best fish fry I've ever had has been walleye. What
Absolutely.
Makes that so good, Nick?
The fish itself is nice and lean. It's very, very mild, so whatever flavoring you put in the breading or in your batter is going to end up being what you experience. It's slightly sweet. It's nice and thin, so it'll cook real fast, but it's still got enough mass that it's not going to dry out if you take your eye off of it for a minute.
We're talking to Nick Sheeler, executive chef for The Packing House in Milwaukee. They are known for their Friday night fish fry, and we'd love to hear from you. What is your favorite fish for fish fry? What do you have to have on the side? We'll get into sides in a minute. Is it the potato pancakes or the fries? Where's your favorite place to go for a fish fry? And if you're going to be eating at Port Washington's Fish Day tomorrow, or cooking, the world's largest one-day outdoor fish fry, let us know about that. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. As Port Washington celebrates the world's largest one-day outdoor fish fry tomorrow, we're celebrating the tradition of fish fries across Wisconsin today on Food Friday. Nick Sheeler stays with us. He's executive director of The Packing House in Milwaukee, known, among other things, for their fish fry. And we'd love to hear from you. What is your favorite fish to use in a fish fry, or to eat at a fish fry? Where do you go for a great fish fry? And what sides are key? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we go to calls, Nick, I wanted to ask you about sides. What do you serve there with your Friday fish fry?
With our Friday fish fry, everybody gets a side of soft rye cocktail bread with butter, tartar sauce, coleslaw, and then everyone has a choice of potato pancakes or french fries.
Aha. So, yeah, I know there are probably partisans of both, potato pancakes and the fries. You let them go either way on that.
I do let them go either way, but I do have suggestions for them.
Which way do you go?
Being a good German boy, I always have to recommend the potato pancakes.
Yeah, if I'm in a restaurant and the potato pancakes are available, I'm going to get the potato pancakes, because fries you can get just about anywhere.
Right. Anybody can make a decent French fry. Finding a high-quality potato pancake is something you keep coming back for.
Sour cream or applesauce on the potato pancake?
I prefer the sour cream.
Me too. Michelle Good, our board operator, just mouthed the word both. She goes with both. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Sam on the line in Madison. Sam, hi. You're on the air.
Hi there.
What do you think about what's your tip for fish fries, Sam?
Well, the best fish fries that I've ever had have all been up north in and around Minocqua. I live in Madison, but we got a place up on Blue Lake there, and really the walleye and the perch are my two favorites. I've had some incredible fish fries with both of those, and I know cod is the staple, but I would, if I had the option, I would go with either walleye or perch.
And Sam, is this at a restaurant there, or are you catching these and frying them up yourself?
Well, the thing about the walleye and the perch is you can pull them out of any of those lakes there, but and we've caught walleye, not so much perch, but there's walleye in Blue Lake, and I know there is a chance there, but
You're breaking up there, Sam. Lee, that sounds really good. Nick, that sounds really good. And how fresh fish? You mentioned frozen cod earlier. Is fish fry a case where freshness doesn't really matter that much?
When you're dealing with your cod, most of the cod we're going to be seeing here is coming from either the North Atlantic or the North Pacific. So it's just not an option with most of the sea fish. However, we always use fresh perch here, fresh walleye. When you're dealing with your freshwater fish and freshness is an option, it is absolutely the way to go, just because it stays moister longer. The freshness does matter, but it's more important in the freshwater fish than it would be in the ocean fish.
We are talking to Nick Sheeler from the Packing House in Milwaukee. We're talking fish fry on today's edition of Food Friday. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. We have Charles on the line in Cumberland. Charles, hi. You're on the air.
Yes. Pine Ridge Lodge in Stone Lake, Wisconsin. It's in northwest Wisconsin. Has the best fish fry on Friday nights. It's all the walleye you can eat for $14.
Not bad. What makes a walleye, that alone makes it special? What else makes it special?
Oh, it comes with fried chicken, fried bread, and coleslaw.
Fried chicken on the side. That defeats the whole fish on Friday purpose, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess
that's cheating. Okay, but the fish is really good, though.
Oh, it's very good. Excellent. You can get it fried or broiled.
Wonderful. Charles, thanks a lot. Pine Ridge Lodge in Stone Lake. And fried or broiled? Yeah, so, Nick, some non-fried options. Do you serve up at your restaurant non-fish fry fish for Friday night?
Absolutely. We always have broiled cod on our Fridays. That comes with the same sides as the fish fry. And then because everybody loves a walleye, we do have broiled or pan-fried walleye every single night of the week.
And, Nick, I'm scared to cook fish sometimes because I've ruined it in the past, and I'll ruin it again. What's a good tip for a general tip for broiling fish and not getting it wrong?
I would recommend cheating, putting about a quarter inch of water in the bottom of the pan. That'll help prevent sticking, and it'll help keep your fish moist while you're broiling it.
Wonderful, because that's my problem. I overcook it. It gets dry. I love cheating. That's wonderful.
Little bit of water goes a long way.
That's great. We'll go back to our callers, Jeff in Montford. Jeff, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I was going to ask how long, when you're cooking fish in a frying pan and you've got it, let's say it's cod, you've got a dry batter on it, how long do you actually cook it?
Good question, Jeff. How do we know when it's done? How long do we cook it, Nick?
I always use the rule of thumb, GBD, golden brown and delicious.
Okay.
So when your fish is golden brown, looking about if you're looking at about an inch and a half thick piece of cod, you're looking at probably about 3 minutes per side, and you want to make sure you do that at like medium or medium low heat, just because you don't want to cook the outside and leave the inside raw.
And I always want to, when I cook any kind of meat, I want to take a cross-section of the thickest sample. I'll cut it, take a look. What does fish look like to know it's done?
Fish will be glistening, opaque, and white in most cases.
Glistening, opaque, and white. Okay. I wanted to get into coleslaw a bit. You mentioned you serve that on the side. When I make my own coleslaw, it's the mayo kind. Do you go with a mayo-based creamy coleslaw or a vinegar, what I think of more as a German or Polish coleslaw?
We go with the creamy coleslaw here.
Okay. And any reason for that? Just a personal preference?
No, that's our fish fry recipe is as old as the building. So they have been making creamy coleslaw here longer than I have been alive. So that's just the way they've always done it here. And personally, I find the creamy coleslaw a better accompaniment to fish fry than the real sharp vinegared coleslaw.
I got to ask, is there another fish fry outside of the packing house that you go to when you get to get away from your own restaurant?
Personally, I don't have a favorite. That's one of the nice things about living in Milwaukee is I can pick a direction, I can drive for 5 minutes, and I can find a sign that will say Milwaukee's best fish fry. So just about everybody's got one.
Time for one more call. Doug in Lancaster. Doug, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for taking my call. For those of us who are not from the Milwaukee area originally anyway, out here in southwest Wisconsin, we have a little bit of different choices in our fresh fish. Without a lot of lakes around. And one of the best fish fries I ever had is from the least likely and lowliest of fish, the bluegill.
Mm.
A friend of mine cooked some up about a year ago now, actually. And I'll be honest, I was skeptical to try it, but once I did, we couldn't get enough of the stuff.
That's great, Doug. So, thanks a lot. I've had great bluegill fish fry, too. Nick, thanks a lot. We're out of time. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Nick Sheeler. He's the executive chef at the Packing House in Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about the art of the fish fry for today's Food Friday. And by the way, head over to the Central Time Facebook page. We have a recipe from Nick there, a basic breaded fish fry, the ingredients. He talks you through the directions there. And while you're there, share your favorite place to go for fish fry in Wisconsin. A key part of the 1980s, as remembered by me anyway, came back this week. The comic strip Bloom County reappeared more than 25 years after it ended. Berkeley Breathed, the creator of Bloom County, started posting strips on his Facebook page just earlier this week. Now, the original strip followed Bill the Cat, Opus the Penguin, and a cast of human and animal characters, a lot of politics, a lot of pop culture thrown in the mix. Their final plot line had the comic strip being bought and then closed down by a controversial 1980s multimillionaire named Donald Trump. So, did Donald Trump's presidential campaign lead to the return of Bloom County? When somebody asked him on Facebook, the author wrote, quote, "This creator can't precisely deny that the chap you mentioned had nothing to do with it." So I think that means, yeah, a little bit. Now, telling some younger people about it here, Bloom County, I got a little bit of a hashtag What's Bloom County response. But this was back in the 80s. I used to read the opinion pages, the comic pages, and the sports pages. And I always hit Bloom County, had a lot of the books. It was a big part of my 80s memories. So it'll be interesting to see what the old gang has to say about modern day pop culture and politics. Coming up next, news from NPR and WPR, then our weekly roundup of the top stories in Wisconsin news. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.